U.S. Legal Support is a proud sponsor of the Legal Face-Off podcast. With over 85 locations around the country and one of the leading providers of litigation services, U.S. Legal Support is the only litigation support company that not only provides a full suite of court reporting solutions to major insurance companies, corporations, and law firms nationwide, they also provide their clients with record retrieval, interpreting and translations, trial services, and transcription services. You can always count on U.S. Legal Support to provide reliable and efficient litigation support services. Visit uslegalsupport.com to find out more.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. It's the Thanksgiving episode of Legal Face Off. Welcome to it here on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Legal Eagles here, Rich and Tina. My name is Sam. Are we ready for Thanksgiving? Are you deep frying the turkey? Anybody? Anybody
going to
deep fry?
No,
I don't celebrate the Thanksgiving as a Canadian. Our Thanksgiving was like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yours is Boxing Day, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, Rich will be the Grinch, and we'll wait to the Hanukkah episode to get him in this.
That's right.
No, Festivus. You got to remember Festivus.
Okay, I am just way off on my holiday conversation here. Big show.
Excited for the Spinal Tap discussion in a few minutes.
There's a lot to get to on this show, per usual. And Ben Anderson is across the glass, joining us on the phone to lead things off. Kim Whaley, professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Former assistant U.S. attorney and a former associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation. She's the author of the book, How to Read the Constitution and Why, and Kim joins us now on WGN. Hi, Kim.
Hi there.
Kim, we appreciate the time. We know you've been all over CBS in your role as their legal analyst, so obviously whirlwind week, a lot to catch up on, but give our listeners maybe a couple of pieces of new evidence that we've learned from the testimony this week that the Democrats are going to use to build their case for impeachment against President Trump.
Well, we had a total of 12 witnesses that consistently said that there was an understanding that the Ukrainians had to make an announcement of investigations, not necessarily do an investigation. Gordon Sondland made it clear it was the announcement that mattered to the president, that was necessary in order to, number one, get a White House meeting. And we learned today why that White House meeting was so crucial for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians have been fighting since 1991 to stave off Russian aggression, and having the American president have their backs in that moment was absolutely crucial to shoring up democracy. The other thing that the president held up was the nearly $400 million in military aid, also necessary to stave off Russian aggression. And we heard from multiple witnesses that Rudy Giuliani was the front man. Rudy Giuliani was the person that the president said, go talk to Giuliani. He's the one you need to deal with in order for me to play ball in Ukraine. So what we did not hear is any witness that said, I spoke to the president. This president personally directed me to withhold the aid, for example. But we heard over and over again that it was through Rudy Giuliani. And of course, that was already in the July 25th summary of the phone call that the White House issued. And so the question is, does anyone really believe that Rudy Giuliani wasn't acting at the direction of President Trump? I think the answer to that, for most logical people, is no.
And Kim, that announcement that you mentioned, getting back to that, that's so crucial, right? Because that shows, and that was in writing, in emails, and that shows the necessary, I think, mens rea, the intent of the president to gain a political advantage. Why else would you need that announcement publicly if he wasn't trying to gain something personal from this transaction?
Precisely. I mean, one of the defenses is, oh, well, this is really about rooting out corruption. There are a number of problems with that defense, including that Rudy Giuliani was actually working with the formerly corrupt prosecutor, corrupt former prosecutors of Ukraine to smear Marie Yovanovitch. So that corruption narrative doesn't really make sense. But it certainly doesn't make sense if the goal wasn't actually to do the investigation. It was just to announce the investigation. That would be for a purely political rationale, which is what Fiona Hill called a domestic political errand, is, I think, the words that will probably go down in infamy from Fiona Hill, the idea being this had nothing to do with foreign policy, with national security, with America's interests. In fact, it was contrary to America's interests. And that's really what's of concern with impeachment. Taking actions as president to shore up and entrench personal power and doing it at odds with what's best for America. And there really isn't a counter narrative from the Republican side for that. It's pretty much one witness after another making clear this was bad for America. This was bad for Ukraine, but it was really good for Vladimir Putin, and it was really good potentially for Trump personally in securing his power in 2020.
So, Kim, most Republicans are arguing that even if there's a quid pro quo here, that it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Wearing your hat as a constitutional scholar, can you walk through for our listeners what your position is on this?
Sure. So I think the argument has to do with this idea of bribery, because, of course, bribery is in the actual Constitution, and there's a statute that was passed by Congress in 1962. And the Supreme Court has said, you know what, to criminally prosecute a public official for bribery, the standard is pretty high to put that person in jail, because we don't want sort of regular activities of politicians to somehow be criminalized by prosecutors. Well, we have to be careful. That's really different from what the framers considered bribery to be in 1788, when the Constitution was ratified. They were thinking about common law England. They were thinking about Charles II being essentially bribed by the French. They're worried about, as we talked about, using the power of the office, the unique power that whoever's in the presidency has. Nobody else on the planet has that level of authority over the military, over the criminal justice system, over federal dollars. That's an immense amount of power, and the idea is you can't use that for yourself. Could only use that for the American people. So I think the argument that this doesn't rise to the level of impeachment is a technical legal argument that does not really, I think, squarely address the reason behind the impeachment clause, which is abuse of power.
Kim, your book, How to Read the Constitution and Why, is a really easy read. It's, you know, I think people are often intimidated by books about the Constitution. They think it's,
yes,
you know, really lawyer-like and scholarly. Yours is really clear and I think very common sense in its approach. And obviously it comes out at a really interesting time in our history. Talk to us about how you think the protections afforded by the Constitution are eroding at a time when we really need them the most, and also what can ordinary Americans do to understand this really, you know, crucial document and protect it at this crucial point in our history?
Yeah, so the book is sort of, it approaches the Constitution from a common sense standpoint, from a sort of your regular life standpoint. And to answer your question, why are we in potentially a dark moment for the Constitution? It really is just common sense, right? So if you drive down the street and there's a speed limit and you know that there's a speed camera that's hiding behind the bushes, most people, once they realize that, will slow down, right? If there is no ticket, people will blow through the speed limit. And we know it was the day after Robert Mueller finished his testimony, and essentially it was clear that the 2016 Russian interference, the president's sort of involvement in that process, was not going to be held. There's no accountability for that. The next day is when the president had the phone call with Ukrainian minister President Zelensky. So the issue is, if we enhance the power of the presidency by not issuing tickets for violating speed limits, we are creating an office that then will go on to the next generation, the next president, with no limits. The speed limits won't matter anymore because no one is issuing tickets. If the judicial branch can't issue tickets because you can't prosecute a sitting president pursuant to internal Department of Justice policy, that branch is out, then it has to be the Congress. The only way the Congress can do it is through oversight. It's been frustrated through denials of subpoenas, not responding to subpoenas, but through impeachment. We have to, as a country, make sure that that office doesn't get too much power. And to answer your question, what's the first step ensuring that? Number one is education. A third of Americans asked in 2015 by the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania could not name all three branches of government. And that's absolutely critical.
That's unbelievable,
the three branches,
by the way,
that check each other, right? So how can people understand the importance of impeachment if they don't understand structurally? We don't have a monarchy. It's flat out wrong to suggest impeachment is unconstitutional. It's in the Constitution. Why? To protect regular people from a bullying government. So number one is education, and the book is a start. It really tries to lay stuff out in ways that people can understand, but also grappling with the theory, not just describing the Constitution.
Even Sam knows that it's
my new book.
Even Sam knows it's the DMV, post office, and what's the third branch of government, Sam?
Lake Michigan?
There you go.
I thought it was the executive, the legislative, and the judicial.
There
you go. That right?
Nice. Yeah,
there's knocks it out of the park.
There's another statistic. 10% of people thought that the Supreme Court includes Judge Judy.
Oh, my God.
But maybe 10%. It should. Maybe it should.
Maybe it should. Well, really like
where's Judge Wapner when you need him?
But my number two answer is to vote, right?
Absolutely.
It's actually the next book, the next summer, not to plug, but there'll be a book called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why, and I've done a lot of thinking about this as a scholar, and at the end of the day, that's the way to take back democracy. Even if you're in a district where you feel like your vote doesn't matter, if your vote didn't matter, people wouldn't be trying so hard to make it difficult to vote. So that's number two. Number one, educate yourself. Number two, get out and exercise the privilege of the franchise that we have in America.
I love that. Not to plug, but I'm going to go ahead and plug. That's Kim Whaley, and the book is How to Read the Constitution and Why. Kim, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff here in Chicago on WGN Radio. Arun Rao is the president of IGI, and he joins us now. The conversation rolls on, and Rich and Tina, so does the Trump impeachment hearings. Arun, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How about this view? Nice. Like 18 floors up, looking out over the beautiful lake and river.
It's gorgeous. It's a beautiful city. I always love coming to Chicago, even if it's cold.
Well, it's great to have you in studio. We know you're busy. So we want to talk about the impeachment hearings. This week, of course, Trump attacked some of the witnesses who are testifying in the hearings at Congress. He attacked Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and even went after former Ukrainian Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch while she was testifying. As an attorney who spent much of his career in public service, how does this behavior strike you?
It strikes me as abhorrent and frankly un-American. And I want to explain what I mean by un-American. It's not in keeping with the ideals of our country. And what I find interesting about the impeachment proceedings is that it's provided the public with an opportunity to really hear from some incredible public servants. You get a chance to observe people who have dedicated their lives to government service and who sought to benefit not themselves personally, but their nations, their fellow citizens, and thereby helping to promote rule of law. You know, your prior guest was talking about the Constitution and has written extensively about it. When Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of government the founders were building, he said, reportedly, he replied with the words, "It's a republic if you can keep it." And what you see with these people are folks who are trying to do exactly that. They are trying to preserve the Constitution. It's not a self-executing document. It comes with a condition, and that's that we need to keep it. And when we talk about rule of law, we're talking about the principle that the U.S. is governed by not the arbitrary decisions of an individual, not what he is personally interested in, but by consistency, predictability, and to have the rule of law enforced, it depends upon the character of the people who are interpreting that law and who are helping to execute it. And, you know, George Kent, who's one of the witnesses who has been subject to a lot of criticism from the president's defenders, when he testified, he said, there's an issue about people in office in countries around the world using selectively motivated political prosecutions to go after their opponents. And that's wrong for the rule of law, regardless of what country it happens in. And so, you know, for a long time, what's attracted our country to so many around the world has been our ideals, that our system of government is imperfect, but it's better than so many other places around the world. But the path ahead for the country in these very fraught and perilous times depends upon precisely the kind of people that we've seen testify over the last week. People like George Smith, people like Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who you mentioned before, people like George Kent. I mean, I have just been really struck by how accomplished and dedicated these public servants have been. George Kent is a Harvard graduate. He's a career diplomat. He speaks Ukrainian and Russian. He's been with the State Department since 1992. Clearly a very talented individual who could have gone on to make a lot of money doing something else. And instead, he's dedicated a life to service. Fiona Hill, she was the National Security Council official. I think she testified yesterday. She was, you know, the daughter of a coal miner from England. She has very modest backgrounds. She left Britain. And I think one of the things she said in her remarks was that there were opportunities. Her background would have been more of a handicap for her in a very class-driven society like the UK. But she was able to get away from that and come to the United States. She's earned a PhD in history from Harvard. She has been serving under both Republicans and Democrats. She was a deputy to H.R. McMaster. These are people who truly embrace everything that America has to offer. Really, what struck me is she said that she can say with confidence that the country has offered me opportunities I never would have had in England. And that, I think, as someone who's the child of immigrants to this country, it's just really inspirational. And I hope that with all the terrible things going on, people are taking away something positive from this impeachment proceeding.
So, Arun, you're a former assistant U.S. attorney. What evidence have you found most compelling as the Democrats build their case against Trump?
It's not any particular piece of evidence that has struck me as really important in terms of what I've seen. It is the overwhelming amount of credible evidence that really has struck me. As a prosecutor in closing arguments, we would always direct the jury to the individual relevant and compelling pieces of evidence, but also as to how that evidence has been corroborated. Any particular witness can have their credibility and motivations attacked, but it becomes very difficult to mount a persuasive defense when there are multiple credible witnesses corroborating each other. And corroboration is key. It was something we would say over and over again as prosecutors, and there has been quite a bit of corroboration. The other aspect of the impeachment proceedings that I've been struck with by is the character of the witnesses themselves, is what I was mentioning before. As a prosecutor, we would frequently ask the jury in closing arguments, what motive do these witnesses have to lie to make up this testimony? And in this case, we've seen, you know, the president and his defenders have repeatedly tried to attack and slander these witnesses, but they just haven't been able to move the needle in terms of credibly impugning their motives.
And it's so interesting, as someone who also tries a lot of cases before juries, how much juries really do pick up on the nuances of credibility and character. And, you know, good or bad, sometimes it's bad. Sometimes they don't focus on the substance as much as the credibility, but often that is really what you want them to focus in on, especially with people of high character like this. Final question we have is, as president of IGI, Arun, one of your responsibilities is, in fact, advising clients on crisis and risk management. If you represented the president right now, what would be your techniques to manage what is a huge crisis going on right now in our country and his administration?
The president strikes me as someone who's resistant to good advice.
But he's his own crisis manager, right? He thinks
that may be one of the most accurate comments we've had on the show, actually.
I would have a very simple suggestion for him, and it is that when you are faced with a crisis, it's profoundly important not to engage in actions that compound your difficulties, things that make the situation worse. And for example, if one were to be investigated, don't do things that might constitute obstruction of that investigation, right? Don't engage in witness tampering. Don't attack a witness via Twitter while they are testifying. This crisis wasn't thrust upon the president. It's one of his own making in so many ways. And so my advice for the president would be, look, don't make things worse. The situation you face is already challenging enough. But I don't think he's going to take that.
And just really quickly, as a former federal prosecutor, we've had many on, and they all say the same thing. What you look for in prosecuting these cases is the crime, but also the cover-up, because the cover-up shows indisputable evidence of conscientiousness of guilt. Mm-hmm. And that's something you could actually take to the jury and they can understand. Whereas maybe the crime is hard to understand. You dealt with a lot of, you know, really complex crime involving, you know, financial schemes. But what you can explain to the jury is how the actions taken after the crime show conscientiousness of guilt.
Absolutely. Consciousness of guilt is crucial to these types of cases in terms of really getting somebody to understand if they didn't do it, they wouldn't behave this way.
Yep. Excellent.
That is Arun Rao, the president of IGI. Thank you, sir, for coming in. Appreciate it. And we'll hope to do it again soon.
Thank you.
We all know the legal world is complex and high pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Legal Face-Off, WGN Radio. You can always find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and, of course, wherever you consume your podcast. Please listen, please review, and rate the show. Joining us now as we move from the presidential impeachment hearings to high school drug testing policies, David C. Bloomfield, professor of education, leadership, law, and policy at Brooklyn College and the author of American Public Education Law, joining us now on the phones here in Chicago. Professor, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So, Professor, high school drug testing continues to increase across the country. A 2016 Centers for Disease Control study said that over 37% of school districts had adopted a drug testing policy of some sort, and the numbers continue to rise. Do these types of policies, in your opinion, meaningfully prevent drug use among youth?
The research isn't clear about whether they prevent drug use. So the deterrence factor is up in the air. They certainly do catch some drug abuse by students, and the question becomes whether it's worth the expense and the interference, you might say even the violation of those students, to conduct the drug testing.
Professor, there's lots of discussion about how lawful drug testing in 2002, the Supreme Court upheld random drug testing among public high school students, and the lawfulness of such testing hinges on there being a reasonable suspicion for testing a particular student. What are some of the unintended consequences of implementing drug testing policies using this standard, and what have we learned from prior instances of testing?
Well, very often what school districts do, because that Supreme Court case was a public school, is random drug testing for voluntary activities. You can't compel people to engage in drug testing when they have to go to school. But if they, in that Supreme Court case, the student was going out for the marching band, and the Supreme Court said that random drug testing in that circumstance was constitutional. Of course, private schools are allowed to set any enrollment requirements that they want, but I am very concerned about opportunities for harassment or bias in the drug testing program.
So do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more? Like, how does that end up playing out?
Right. So in this recent case at the Dayton High School, which is a Catholic school in Ohio, It's a required annual drug test for all students, but any amount of drug testing based on only suspicion. And I would say there's a difference between reasonable suspicion when you have to articulate why you're engaging in the drug test on that particular student and mere suspicion, which could be just a whim and might often be visited on children who are already marginalized in the school. And that includes based on race or other circumstances.
Professor, here in Illinois, as in many states, cannabis is becoming legal effective January 1st. It will be legal across our state. How does that affect the what you're talking about, drug testing policies in schools?
Well, the question to some degree is this about the child's ability to succeed at school, or are we simply using the schools as a policing mechanism to find out whether a kid has smoked pot or vaped or whatever it may be at any time? This Baton High School policy is for any drug at any time. And I think that that probably goes over the line in terms of educational policy, although it's legal.
So what would you recommend to parents who have students who are in school and schools that are subject to drug testing? What do they need to know if their students or if their children are students at these schools that have these drug testing policies? And what would you recommend that they do in the event their children test positive when they're tested?
So what parents need to do is to read the policy. Is the cost of the drug testing passed on to them, or is it the school district's or the school's responsibility? What are the disciplinary measures? Is a student allowed to avoid drug testing for some reason? So all of these are important details that parents have to be aware of and that school administrators and boards of education need to be aware of as they explore the of what is quite an invasive procedure. An adult can't be drug tested on the street just because there's some random drug testing by the government. It's not allowed. So students are a kind of captive audience, and we have to be careful that their educational rights and their rights as individuals are respected.
That is Professor David C. Bloomfield, the website davidcbloomfield.com, and the author of American Public Education Law. Professor, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Legal Grab Bag time on Legal Face-Off. Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini, Sam Paniamish. Thanks to Ben Anderson, per usual, joining us today in the studio. You know him from Team Hochberg, David Hochberg. I said the website wrong. You got to say it for me.
56David.com. That's pretty tough.
You said no. You said 3 W's, 56David.com.
No, it's 56David.com. And the phone number, in case you screw that up, is 855-56-DAVID. So it's pretty simple.
For buying and refinancing homes, check them out, Team Hochberg, 56David.com. And yep. Then Arvin Hassani, who is a Chicago-Kent College of Law.
That's right.
Law student.
Hello.
In the house. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Rich, seven topics per usual. And let's lead off with the Ohio University hazing death. Great start.
Yeah, well, you know, we cover all stories here on Legal Face-Off. On Tuesday of this week, nine men, including seven members of the Sigma Pi fraternity, were indicted by an Athens County jury, grand jury, in connection with events that prosecutors allege led to the death of an 18-year-old student, Colin Wyant, who collapsed and died during an off-campus fraternity event at Ohio University last November. This is one of many examples of hazing that has gone wrong and that has led to both civil and criminal issues. Wyant's family is suing the fraternity and the university civilly, but this is a criminal action where it's alleged that several of the students involved were guilty of anything ranging from first-degree involuntary manslaughter, which, by the way, carries a maximum penalty of 11 years in prison, to others were charged with reckless homicide, which is a third-degree felony, which has a maximum of 5 years. But what's interesting about this prosecution is that they also charged some of the sellers. One of the hazing incidents was involving Whippets, which is nitrous oxide. And they are suing some of the seller or the store that sold it to them. Raises a lot of interesting legal questions about liability and how far you extend liability, both civilly and criminally. Of course, in a civil setting, you know, as we say all the time on this show, you could sue anyone for anything. Criminally, though, what do we think? Should liability criminally extend to not only the participants? And by some accounts, they force this person to use cocaine, and they forced him to ingest, you know, unbelievable amounts of alcohol and nitrous oxide, but should also extend to people who sell this. And by the way, this is commercially available on Amazon, at Walmart. So do you sue, you know, Jeff Bezos? What do we think?
Well, I think you raised some very interesting issues. And I think a lot of it, number one, is because of the awareness, the increased awareness of these sorts of incidents. I think more people have died relatively recently. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's a very fact-specific analysis. I think if folks know why certain people are purchasing certain items, there's a certain level of knowledge there that I think distinguishes it from somebody who's selling like a Whippet, for example, who has no idea why it's being used. So I think it depends on the circumstances, but it depends on the level of knowledge.
Dave, what do you think on this? You were anxious to get in.
I was the president of my fraternity up in Northern. And the
Fellow Husky,
Pi Kappa Alpha, class of 88, School of Business, but yes, not the School of Law. And I was up there, and when I was a president, Dram Shop was coming through.
Sure.
And we used to be able to buy insurance for four mixers a year for $300. And by the time I graduated, it was $1,000 a party. And it became prohibitive as to what we were doing. And we used to buy 20 kegs a party and all that stuff. And we had a similar situation in Northern. And it kicked the Pi Kappa Alpha house off because a young man, a pledge, I don't know exactly, you know, was doing some type of progressive or something, you know, drink. Each room had a different drink, and he passed away.
Yeah, we cover that story extensively.
Right.
Yeah.
It was my fraternity, and they kicked him off. So my whole thing is this. You know, I understand you're 18, and I went through training as a president. They scared the living bejesus out of me down in Memphis as to what to do. And I watered down the booze in our house when we had initiation to make sure nobody fell asleep in a cornfield and died, and I was going to jail. So I think there has to be some type of education throughout the national fraternities to educate, especially now it's so prevalent. Back in the 80s, like, yeah, let's go. We'll go get a keg, and everybody's drinking. You know, drinking age was 18 back then. But it's like beyond excessive now, and more kids are dying. I don't know if being reported more now and not back then. You know, when did you go to school? In the 80s as well? Were you down there?
I was at Northern for law school. I graduated in 95, and okay, I went to all the fraternity parties because I had buddies who were brothers there. And, I mean, they were crazy, but I don't think they're anywhere near what we're seeing today.
Right. It's nuts.
And listen, a lot of people blame it on the culture of video games where you just press reset and you get to start things over. That might be a little bit simplistic, but I think it's a bit of a different culture now. But listen, you're in a unique position because you are the most recent college student.
So, yeah.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to DePaul University. Okay. I was in a fraternity, graduated 2014. So you mentioned how you want to see more education on this issue. What I thought was kind of interesting was that when I went to college, that was sort of in the public eye of everyone who was in a fraternity. That's sort of that thing that they tried to hammer in, and education on that topic was really huge. Mm-hmm. I was in a fraternity that didn't haze, particularly because of that, because they're really strong about that. And what kind of struck me as really odd about this story is that despite that education, something like this is still happening.
I agree. It is. I mean, listen, I have a 14-year-old. She's a freshman in high school, and I am impressed at how much these kids know and how educated they are about things like vaping and drugs. And I think the next generation like her won't do this stuff as much. Maybe that's naive, but I know, for example, with vaping, like I'm hammering into her every day about all the stories of people dying. We just heard yesterday another person died from vaping. Yeah. So I agree with you that I think the education is hitting home. And it's shocking that stuff like this is still going on. I don't know how people are still dying from this and how universities are allowing it. I represent a lot of universities, a lot of colleges, so I understand the issues about liability and they can't control everything. But, you know, it's really surprising this is still going on. So in some respects, I think lawsuits like this will have hopefully the impact that they're intended to.
Well, I think it's an attitude that it's not going to happen to me.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, when we were kids, I mean, you think you're invincible and you think that it's always going to be somebody else and it's never going to be you.
Topic number 2 of 7, legal grab bag, WGN. I'll just read the title. Smell the glove.
David, smell the glove is here. Hello, Janine.
So Spinal Tap, who's a Spinal Tap fan here?
Don't get me started. One of my top three movies of all time.
I was going to say.
No coincidence that this is on the
shocking.
It's rundown today.
I love Spinal Tap, too, but I have a feeling that Rich knows the dialogue a little bit better than I do. So there are a couple lawsuits.
I, for one, don't think it was a question of the band being down. I think it was a Stonehenge monument that was in danger of being stomped by a dwarf.
I have a little Stonehenge monument at my house and in honor of Spinal Tap. So there are a couple lawsuits going on right now involving the folks from the movie, including Rob Reiner, Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest,
please,
and Michael McKean.
Spinal Tap names.
Oh, come on. Come on. You do it.
David St. Hubbins, Nigel Tufnell. Go ahead.
So anyway, so I am here to report that one of those lawsuits has settled, and that's the one involving the rights to the soundtrack. The one that's continuing to go on involves the rights in the movie. What started this lawsuit is it relates to the royalties that each of the stars got from the soundtrack. Apparently, the merchandising income between 1984 and 2006 for these guys was about $81. Harry Shearer originally was the only one bringing suit and sought $125 million, and then the claim increased to $400 million after the others joined. So the case was settled on undisclosed terms, but
took a while.
It did take a while.
It's ironic that, you know, Spinal Tap is the ultimate documentary about
It's a mockumentary.
It's a mockumentary about the rock business, and this is real life where this lawsuit involving the band and the record company has gone on forever. So it's kind of, you know, the reality meeting the mockumentary. But have any of you ever seen Spinal Tap? You might be a little young for it.
It's a little bit before my time. I've heard of it. I know it's a cult favorite. It's on the list of things
I told you once. I told you 1,000 times. It's Spinal Tap, then Puppet Show. Hochberg, any thoughts on...
How long has this been going on, and why does it go on?
Movie came out in 84.
Right, and why does the movie studio... Did they sign a contract stating that they weren't entitled to the royalties? I mean, what's the background behind
this? Well, listen, as everyone knows, record company contracts are notoriously fraught with, you know, issues, and the artist gets screwed out of royalties all the time.
Especially back in the 80s, right?
Especially in the 80s when, you know, the... maybe the legal representation wasn't strong, but yeah, it's kind of amazing that this has gone on for so long.
Well, and the case was going on since 2016.
2016.
Yeah. And the case
allegations
were
I mean,
right. The allegations go back
forever.
for years.
So talk about it. You see, I'm a mortgage guy, right? And I look at this and say, you've got three creative actors that did an amazing job with this mockumentary. I can't
yes,
say it.
Yes.
You know, documentary, splice it in mockumentary. Sam, take
we're
it from
there. We're not going to edit that out.
I appreciate it. It's our great 5, 10, 15-year relationship. I appreciate that. But how does, you know, where does that go for so long? That the attorneys could just keep rolling it, and I'm not knocking attorneys and their fees, but how does that keep going without somebody settling this a lot sooner than 2019?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, this is not unusual. And as Tina mentioned, it's only been 3 years that this. I mean, you see cases on the docket that are 10, 15 years old, and you ask the same questions. And the reason is because the court systems, number one, are so congested, they're so backlogged. And while a lot of judges do a good job of moving cases forward, a lot of them don't. And, you know, the parties are. Well, you mentioned one, attorneys are making fees off them. I hate to be so cynical, but the attorneys are not incentivized to settle cases quickly because that will end the cash stream of their fees. Good attorneys like Tina and myself look at the big picture and think, let me settle the case now to avoid additional costs because my client will be well served. But there are other attorneys who, you know, see a value in keeping these cases alive because they could generate fees.
Right. And also, you know, you got to go back to 1984 when this movie came out. I'm not sure people really thought this movie was going to be the hit that it was, right?
No way.
It has become a cult classic, right? Yeah. Just like Rocky Horror. Yeah. Who would have thought back then that it was going to be the classic that it is? So people start caring more sometimes down the road when they realize that there's money to be made, right?
And remember, you can't really dust for vomit.
Great quote. Great quote.
This story out of ABC 13 in Houston, at a murder trial, they tried what they called the sleepwalking defense.
Yeah, it's actually a defense that's been around forever and used effectively, believe it or not, in many cases. The idea being that, you know, while you're sleepwalking, you can't form the necessary intent, mens rea, whatever you want to use, whatever term you want to use to meet the standard for murder. In the most recent case in Houston this month, a man who was convicted of killing his wife, claiming he was sleepwalking, it didn't work. He was sentenced to 75 years. He said that he was sleepwalking in 2013, and he told his son that he had a dream that he shot and killed his wife. Well, guess what? It wasn't a dream. It was real. He was sleepwalking, he says, and he shot his 63-year-old wife half dozen times, including two shots to her head, one to her back, and he said that his actions were involuntary because of his sleep-like states. As I mentioned, this defense has worked. A lot of people, you know, deem it junk science, but there are experts who will, you know, who have apparently credibly before a jury convinced people that you can form the necessary intent for murder while you're sleepwalking. Tina, you're on this jury. What do you think of that defense?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances. I don't think it helped that there was testimony that apparently this guy had threatened to kill her many times
while awake.
Yes, not
that,
while sleepwalking.
That was not a fact that was in his
favor.
It
just so happens that he actually carried out that threat while he was sleepwalking, right? Guys, you're laughing?
Well, I don't understand this. So he's having a bowl of cereal with his son and going, I had a dream that I captured mom last night, and mom's lying in bed with a bullet in the back of the head. Is that how this was?
It was just a dream, yeah.
It was just a dream. Yeah. I didn't notice a dead body and all the blood in the bed when I got up to have a bowl of Cheerios with you this morning.
Yeah, Arvin, you represent a lot of defendants in your current work for the
Federal Defender Program. Nothing quite like this.
No. You've seen some interesting theories, though, right?
I mean, a couple. I've been doing mostly cases with the First Step Act, so people who have dealt crack and trying to get them out of prison.
It was my brother.
More like...
Don't know how it got there.
Yeah, but I will say...
sidestepped that quite very good.
These are all
counselor.
Sam, yes.
Very good.
Sam just happens
I don't
to
want to comment on any of my
criminal excuses.
I blacked out. What happened?
I don't want to comment on any of my clients
today. It wasn't my glove.
I was drinking a Hochberg's fraternity party.
I don't own isotoners.
You're still alive, though. So there you go. Good leadership.
I had great insurance from a Sycamore insurance agent.
Company. Yeah.
So this is a defense that we did not learn about in crim law. We must have skipped that section. But when you look at this guy's history, he has a history of domestic violence. When you look at how accurately he was able to commit the murder, it's no surprise to me that a jury didn't buy it. I believe she was shot twice in the head and then four times in the back.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think when you legal issues aside, just do you even believe that he was asleep?
Sam, what's the craziest thing you've done while sleepwalking? Is that even mentionable?
I played the fifth.
Uh-huh.
Did I say that right? Is it the fourth or the fifth?
It's the fifth.
All right.
Well, for you,
you can use
both.
Yeah, you need both. You need the protections of two federal amendments.
Speaking of the fourth, topic number four, one of Tina's favorites, Madonna has been sued by fans for being late to her own concert.
About time.
Yeah.
Is it about time?
Damn time someone sued.
Did you sue her?
Damn right. I'm in on this.
I knew you were upset.
Can't stand waiting for Madonna anymore.
Oh, my Enough. God. So, yeah. So, we have a fan here, Nate Hollander, who was a Florida ticket holder who made the sad mistake of buying several tickets to go see Madonna. And the time on the ticket said that the concert would start at 8:30. Well, he paid a pretty penny for these tickets, over $1,000. And as he was holding the tickets before the actual show time, the time went from 8:30 to 10:30, the start time. And so he tried to get a refund because in his mind, 10:30 is a little too late on a school night to be going to see Madonna. And unfortunately, he wasn't getting a refund. And so he decided to sue. And so apparently there are a number of fans jumping on the bandwagon who have just had enough and don't think that it's right for them to be able to change the start time of the concert to 10:30. So it's funny. I actually have a couple of friends who got rid of their tickets for this very reason. They used a ticket exchange at work to sell the tickets because the start time changed from 8:30 to 10:30. So
listen, on the one hand, you could argue like, caveat emptor, because it's Madonna, for Christ's sake, and like she's made her career as a diva, and you should expect
proud of it.
Yeah, you should expect that she's going to be late. On the other hand, I love it. I mean, I go to a lot of concerts, going to see Elvis Costello tonight here
really?
Locally
Where's
in Chicago,
playing?
Chicago Theater.
Oh, nice. I've
not
seen him. He's
sponsoring
great.
Our show, so I'm not going to give them a big plug. But, you know, yes, you should have some reliability. People have lives. People have babysitters. They have schedules. You can't just show up at, you know, 8:30 expecting the artist to come on that time and wait 2 hours. So
just remember, the queen is never late. She actually said that. The queen is never late.
But there's all examples. I mean, this happened in Vegas, and this goes on all the time, where people like Guns N' Roses were famous for showing up like 4 or 5 hours late.
Sinatra.
Right?
Was notorious for sitting in the back talking to the mobsters.
Right.
Where are you going to go? Hey, Frank, we got 3,000 people in the ballroom. Why don't you come out? I don't think so. Yeah.
I went to see Snoop Dogg in Vegas. Concert time, 8 p.m. 8 p.m.
Showtime.
Yeah. He came out at 11:15.
Rocked
out
of his mind.
You were so high by then, you didn't know
the difference.
I had a contact high coming in the door. No, it was funny because this was actually last football season. It was that college football game when LSU played Texas A&M. It was a 7-overtime game. It was like 70-70. He was ripping blunts in the back watching the game. And everything came out later because the opening act was watching the game. But Snoop was 3 hours late to stage.
He's notorious for that. He did the same at Riot Fest. Ruined my time.
Yeah, so listen, Arvin, people criticize lawyers of abusing the system for frivolous lawsuits. Mm-hmm. Is this an example of that, or is this person doing us all a favor by maybe incentivizing artists to stick to the start time?
Well, on one hand, I want to say, I mean, if you're a rock star, you had one job.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, to get there on time. But also, I mean, you buy the tickets with the underlying idea that they're, you know, you have a certain amount of facts that are underlying there that you bought the tickets based on. So, I mean, when those change, I don't know. I understand the need to feel a little bit ripped off there. I can't really be too sympathetic for Madonna here. I don't think this is frivolous.
Hawkberg?
I'd go another direction. I'd sue for Madonna charging $1,000 to see her, you know, for a ticket to see her concert.
Yeah, and it's
maybe
it's
in the
not
80s.
1992,
yeah,
right?
Maybe, you know, like a virgin when, you know, if she was giving away some of those coffee books, you know, those nude coffee books that she was giving away.
Sex,
back in the day.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Remember that?
Yeah, trust me. I know it very well.
Arvin, before your time, there was a time when there was not actually free porn. And Madonna sold a book called Sex, and it was wrapped up in plastic. And, you know, you'd have to actually pay money to see naked pictures of Madonna. People lined up for
sold
blocks
out.
And blocks.
And Rich was at the front of the line?
He's got 7 copies.
Yeah. Are you speaking from memory?
I can afford it. I got the alternative version. It was
the Ditto version.
It was a Madonna impersonator. It was a dude selling pictures of himself.
When did Madonna get an Adam's apple?
Yeah. All right, we got to ask the inevitable question. Favorite Madonna song, Sam?
Like
go.
A Virgin.
Come on. So easy.
Well, that's my favorite song.
All right, go ahead. Tina?
I have a couple. Okay. I love Like
I
a Prayer.
Would. Yes.
And I love Material Girl.
Material Girl, yes. Great video.
Excellent. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. She was gorgeous in that video.
Mm-hmm. Arvin?
Who?
Oh, my God.
I was never a Madonna fan.
No,
she always it gave me a headache. Listen, I always punched out.
You
no.
Should I break out my Vogue?
Yeah, that's very good. I was you in the black leather plastic suit.
The resemblance is uncanny,
yeah,
Rich.
That's right.
Remember Vanilla Ice was in the sex book, too.
I did not know
yeah.
that.
I had that one.
That guy grossed me out. He totally grossed me out.
Well, our friend Jose Canseco, who Sam knows, he's got some great Madonna stories from his brief time dating her back in the day. So
does Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
And so does like half the Yankees.
I was going to say, who didn't date
her? Now's a great time, by the way, to mention Renegades. Starring Jose Canseco, coming back to Vegas very soon. Stay
Congrats.
Tuned.
That was Absolutely. When, didn't Rodman wear the dress? Madonna yeah. didn't wear the dress.
Yes. Yeah.
Rodman wore the dress.
Or for his, what was that, for a book signing? Or
no,
was
they
for,
got married.
Oh, that's right.
They
that's
got
right.
married.
Right.
Dennis Rodman had
I'm thinking
minutes.
Howard Stern for the book signing wore the dress.
We're going down the rabbit hole. Three topics yeah. to go here on the Legal Grab Bag.
We should call this the Legal Rabbit Hole, by the way. It's an alternative title. Not bad.
May have just fallen into something. Naked pilot arrested.
Yes, this is a great story. So,
just saying it is great. Just the title is awesome.
So we have a pilot. Well, so we've got a pilot. He is a United Airlines pilot who made the sad mistake of being in the city of Denver at a hotel naked in front of his hotel room window. So he ends up getting... he ends up getting arrested. He is in his room. Denver police, after they get the report from folks who are in the airport and who purportedly can see him naked from his window.
Didn't appreciate the nakedness of the pilot,
they
apparently.
Didn't. And I still am not confident that people didn't have binoculars here because the distance was such that it's a little bit questionable whether they could actually see him naked from the airport. But mm-hmm. apparently he's standing in front of the window. He is buck naked. People see him, frontal nudity, call the police. Police go to his hotel room and they arrest him. And then the guy's out of work for 6 months. So where we are right now is there was a lawsuit. There was a settlement. The city of Denver has agreed to pay the pilot $300,000. There is a law that you cannot knowingly expose your genitals to the front view of any person.
What?
But... that conduct
Sam
has to be...
Sam is never going back to Denver
Since
now.
Since when?
Yeah. But, guilty as charged.
But it has to be... There has to be an intent there. And there also has to be people who have to actually be able to see it. And so, bottom line, it is still legal to be naked in Denver.
Thank God. Enough said. Don't cancel my trip to Colorado now. No, listen, I mean, this is on the one hand maybe an example of a little bit aggressive police action. If you see the body cam video, they barged in and they grabbed him up while he was naked and unsuspecting, and probably never want to grab up a naked person while, you know.
Well, it depends.
Well, maybe.
If you're a law enforcement officer, probably not. But yeah. in other instances, might be a good time.
Maybe a little bit taking the letter of the law too seriously. I mean, clearly... You know, was he intending to just?
He got engrossed in a conversation.
His manhood.
20-minute conversation in front of a mirror, in front of a window.
Who among us hasn't forgotten to put on pants when you're talking on the phone? Maybe
that's the way I start my day, buddy. I'll be full disclosure.
No pun intended.
I'm naked. We're doing loans. Six in the morning. You're calling me. Boom.
Whatever.
First call of the day. No clothes on.
Yeah.
I just thought.
Extra
should I call you in the afternoon?
You should call me anytime.
Better
if I want to make sure.
Better rate
on.
While you're naked. Maybe you shave a point. Maybe you shave a half point without pants.
Yeah, no pun intended. There you go.
There you go.
Arvin, you look like you can't wait to jump in here.
I have no comment on this, but yeah.
He's trying to graduate law school at this point.
That's what happens in about 10 years, 15 years. You find this funny, so I know.
Would you feel confident flying on the airplane back from Denver if you knew this was your pilot?
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds like any older man who forgets, who's like on the phone and goes into conversation. I mean,
yeah. Happens when you lose your
mind. Happens.
Happens when you
What's
lose your
definition
mind.
Of older?
Yeah, exactly.
A vegan man has sued Burger King, and there was a lot going on here because they have the Impossible Whopper, but they cook it sometimes right next to the actual Whopper.
Another class action lawsuit.
Through a drive-thru. The man was through a drive-thru. You have to make that clear.
Absolutely. Class action lawsuit filed just Monday here in the United States District Court for the Southern District down in Florida. And the plaintiff is saying that the Burger King food chain failed to disclose that, as you mentioned, they cooked the Impossible Whopper, which is plant-based, on the same grill that they cook meat on.
And Burger King has responded that you can ask for the Impossible Burger to be cooked some other way than on the broiler. My take on this, having defended many restaurants from many frivolous lawsuits, is what are the damages, right? What damages did this person suffer to clog up our loss? You know, we talked earlier about why cases take so long. Here is Exhibit A. Someone's suing a major corporation in a class action, so alleging that a class of people are harmed because their burger was grilled on the same grill as a meat-based grill. I mean, to me, it's nonsensical. I understand the concept, but again, there are multiple parts to any lawsuit, and you have to prove actual damages. And what possible damages did this person suffer
from? So why
did
an attorney take this?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. What do you think the answer is?
Well, I understand. I mean, it's a redundant question for money. But, you know, you talk about clogging up the court system with nonsense.
Yeah.
And this is just like, okay, I'm going through a drive-thru ordering an Impossible Burger. Okay? Yeah. You've been in restaurants. My in-laws owned a couple of McDonald's. I've been in McDonald's. It's not like the Taj Mahal back there, okay? You got a limited amount of room to turn food out in under 2 minutes, or else you're going to have people suing you for taking more than 2 minutes because you're in a fast food place. You pull into a driveway, order an Impossible Burger. Where the hell do you think they're going to cook this thing?
Yeah.
Okay?
You're at Burger King, for Christ's sake.
You're right. Come on. This stuff like this drives me crazy.
Hochberg's the perfect juror for this.
Yeah.
So when I read this, the thing that comes to mind is the word assumption of risk. Mm-hmm. You're walking into a Burger King, and I understand that Burger King likes to sell themselves as being like a little bit above McDonald's, but that's still fast food. That's still a lower quality place you're going to. You're still paying, what, under $10 for a completely vegan burger. At a certain point, if a little bit of meat juice gets on a burger, gets on your organic patty,
get over it.
Yeah.
Snowflake, Tina, these cases have gone on forever. I mean, there are cases involving buffalo wings, wild wings in New York. A woman sued them in 2016, saying that they failed to disclose that their French fries and mozzarella sticks had been cooked in beef fallow. The judge dismissed it, again, saying, where's the proof of injury? It's one thing, you know, there are a lot of peanut allergy lawsuits that you see. That's one thing, because the damages are real.
That's health.
Right? I mean, that's a health issue. But if you're sitting on this jury, how do you react to the claim of damages here?
Well, I mean, I don't see the damage here. And people, I think, have to get very particular about identifying what the damage is before you can expect to see any kind of damages from big corporations in this context.
A record for the use of damages in one answer, for sure.
Huh?
That's a record for the use of the word damage.
10 times Absolutely. In one sentence.
Has anyone tried the Impossible Burger? I haven't tried it.
My wife did.
Not at Burger King or anywhere else. I've tried it in other restaurants.
I had one in Vegas at Ramsay's place. You could barely taste the difference.
Really?
I feel like at Burger King, though, it'd be a little bit different. I just don't have high hopes for a vegan burger at Burger King.
I'll tell you what. I had the Impossible Patty at Dunkin' Donuts, you know, that.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
Really?
And I watched them make it. It goes in the same oven as the microwave, and they hit the button, and 45 seconds later, out comes the sandwich, and I could care less.
Hochberg was watching to make sure they didn't mingle them, because he was ready to file suit.
Yeah, because
he was ready.
I'm jumping right on him. The Dunkin' Donuts in Northbrook.
It's only fitting we have Arvin here for our final topic, involves lawyer salaries. All right.
And my plans, I would like to announce that I'm moving to California.
Yes. Arvin's doing it just for the love of the legal profession. But yeah, Forbes just this week released a study showing which states have the highest and lowest average salaries for lawyers. So you already blew the lead. You already stepped on the lead, Arvin. Good work here. But what do we think, Hochberg? You've seen it also, right?
Yep.
All right. Well, no surprise that California is among the top five. California's highest at $171,000 is the average salary for a lawyer in California. Next is New York at $167,000. I'm actually a little surprised. I thought New York was
too.
One,
because
they
always higher,
set the bar for that. And then Massachusetts came in at third. Illinois is in the top five. Lawyers in our state make on average $153,000 almost. The bottom five, Idaho is there at 99, and the lowest state is Montana at 88,600. I'm surprised. I didn't even know there is a Montana. I didn't know that was a state. Is that still a state? I thought that was gone.
Hey.
I didn't know Montana was a state.
They haven't annexed yet.
Really? I didn't know there was law, by the way, in Montana either. I thought it was like just
Wild West.
Frontier justice. Yeah. So what do we think? Too much money? Not enough money. Lockport, I think the answer that you're going to give is obvious. Although, careful, because you do rely on an industry.
I love attorneys with great credit making six figures. 855-56-DAVID for all your refinancing and purchasing needs.
There you
go. It's a free market, right? Yeah, I think it's great. You want to make $2 million a year as an attorney, as a truck driver, as a whatever. God bless you. If somebody's willing to pay it, it's America. You should be able to charge whatever you want. People should be. I was just talking to an attorney last night at the hockey game. And he's like, you know what? I read a book where it says I should raise my rates 50% and I'll lose 40% of my clients, but I'll make more on the 60% that retain me and I'll work less. And I'm just like, okay. And he tried
voodoo
it.
Economics right there.
No, I'll tell you what. He tried it and it worked for him, right? Because the way that he implemented it and everything else, he has less clients, charging the clients that he has more money so he could spend more time with them. He was able to cut staff. And he's having a much more profitable year this year implementing that system. It's just a thought.
All right, you're in your last year of law school. Yes, you're hitting the home stretch here. Mm-hmm. How important is starting salary, to someone entering the legal market like yourself?
I mean, that really depends on why you decide to go to law school. I think when I decided to go to law school, everybody told me you're not going to make a lot of money your first few years. So if you're in it, to be swimming in cash, that's probably not the right profession for you to go into because it's going to take a while until you start seeing salaries like this.
And it's important to remember, by the way, that coming out of law school, unlike many professions, most students have some considerable debt, right? Yeah. Some considerable student loans on top of what they might have already taken in undergrad, right? I mean, law school is not cheap, and, tempered with these high salaries are the debt you're going to pay to finance that. Tina, you're involved, have been for years in hiring law students. You know this market intimately. What are your thoughts on these numbers, and should these salaries be higher, lower? What are your thoughts on this? I think they should be higher, of course.
Very funny.
For the level of service we provide.
I agree with the comment that it's a market-driven system, and there are several things that are at play. As you mentioned, the debt is a big part of it. People need to go to law school. They need to pay for it. A lot of times they don't have the financial wherewithal to pay for it without taking loans out. It's becoming more and more expensive. But also, as you mentioned earlier, the New York market really drives a lot of this, and it drives not just the market dynamics, but it's a quest for talent. And at the end of the day, if you've got a relatively limited pool, you've got more people interested in hiring the talent than you have talent, it's going to drive the price up. And so a lot of what you're seeing with at least certain pockets of salaries among certain types of employers is they are competing for talent. So it drives the salaries up.
Let's get back to Spinal Tap, Sam. What's your favorite Spinal Tap song, Sam?
I thought we were going to talk about my legal face-off salary.
Yes.
Which I think is due for a bump.
That's
right?
Among the highest in any legal podcast. It's got to be.
One of the best.
It's got to be up there.
Can always be higher, Sam.
Spinal Tap?
Can always be higher.
Back to Spinal Tap. What were we talking about?
What's your favorite song? Come on. Give us. Is it Big Bottom? Is it, Lick My Love Pump is one of our favorite ones?
Not a big Spinal Tap fan.
Really?
No.
Well, check it out. I was born
in 89.
Lick My Love Pump. That was the lines intertwined with lines. It was a combination of Mozart and Bach.
Yeah, how does that start?
It's just a instrumental version, if you've seen the movie. But
one more time.
Nigel describes it, he's a big fan of Mozart and Bach. Mm-hmm. So it's really a mock, is what he describes it as.
I hear the influences.
You've got to see this movie, Sam. It's a great movie.
Well, I'm classic. Just glad that we're getting ready for the caroling episode of Legal Face-Off, which is coming up in December.
A little pitchy. A little pitchy right now.
Our diaphragms. David Hochberg, 56David.com. Thank you, sir, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Arvind Hosseini, who is finishing up his law degree. Good luck to you in the future, and hope to see you soon.
To answer the question, Rich, my favorite song is Big Bottom.
Oh, yeah. Big Bottom. Big Bottom. Big Bottom, talk about mud flaps. My girl's got them. Those are the lyrics. I'm not making them up.
We'll talk to you in December on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going ahead.